I have a question for you guys. This is another thought experiment, provocation, that I'm under the gun for. So I'm going to do something weird for my undergraduate theory class exam. So it begins tomorrow. I'm calling it an examathon because it's going to go for like 2 weeks and it's going to have multiple parts and there's going to be that it's an exam is so totally irrelevant. Basically it's just activities that I'm doing, but you call it an exam and it induces a different kind of, obsession or whatever. So what I have to do tomorrow, and here's what I have to come up with. I have to come up with a prompt. I'm going to put them in some kind of groupings and I have to come up with prompts to which they have to respond in vaguely interesting ways. That's it, right? that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a very good way of doing it. Let me give you the context for it. So last week I tried, I think we talked about it some, this sort of porn thing of the governor's claim that this book that was in the library was obscene material and shouldn't be in a classroom. So I did. I started Thursday's class. Like, I just read the governor's letter. I showed them the book, which is the irony, of course, being that you know how you can actually find the obscene images for the book? It's all the conservative people on Twitter tweeting about it, right? Like, so the irony is, how do you find the obscene material? You go to the people who are critiquing obscene material because that's who's putting it out in the public. And it took me, and you guys know how technologically savvy I am, it took me all of 12 seconds to find all of the offensive images for this book. Like, again, my recurring refrain is like, have these people not heard of the internet? Like, kids have access to, you know, I mean, but again, like, I'm missing, you know, that argument misses the point, right? It's all about generating outrage. Like, it doesn't matter that nothing of consequence, you know, legislatively or anything comes of that. It just is generating, and it just happened in Illinois, I guess, today, the same book, right? It's happened in Rhode Island, Virginia, South Carolina, now Illinois. Like, it's sweeping the nation that whatever Koch Brothers funded operation is going to, like, find someone in a local area because there's this one book in a school that has, like, gay sex, right? And it's whatever. Mm-hmm. So in any case, I put it out there, right? I'm like, okay, here's the governor's letter. Here's the book. Like, you know, we went through the sort of text of the book. And obviously, contextually, it looks obscene, but contextually, you're like, this is this sort of coming of age story, like every other coming of age story. Right. It's just non-binary, right? Like, that's the only difference. And they had nothing. It was just like, this is just people getting outraged. Like, they're just so accustomed to parents being pissed off at schools for some alleged woke behavior or something like that they had no response whatsoever. So it didn't generate anything. Like, we spent 15 minutes on it, and that was basically me saying all the stuff that I just said to you guys.
Right.
You know. So I want to figure out a way of getting some sort of interest or investment in thinking in relationship. Like, I don't even care about, like, you know, it's the theory class. So it was Intro to Theory, 31 flavors. You guys know, you know, that's all I've done is, like, you know, week on feminism, week on subjectivity, week on postmodernism, week on, you know, all those sorts of things. So what can I do?
I mean, if you wanted to keep on that thread or somehow get some more stuff out of that particular example or context, I mean, my immediate thought was, like, why is there a collective response sort of apathetic?
Apathy.
Right, so, like, maybe ask them to kind of deconstruct their own affective response to the situation. Why are they desensitized to internet outrage or collective outrage or, you know, outrage against wokeness? Why do they not even have even a minor investment in these conversations? Obviously, the easy answer is just that there's too much of it everywhere and it kind of, you know, just deadens the whole space of discourse. But I do think sometimes just that basic, I do this prompt with students occasionally, like deconstructing taste, you know, whether it's music or something, is kind of the first into making an argument. You know, like, you can say I like something and then you have to prove why that thing is compelling or interesting is, like, the next stage in making the argument. So
how do you start them into that? Like, even so, because my concern is it's a great idea. I just think it's too meta. Like, I just don't think that they will make that, like...
Yeah.
So what does it indicate that we're apathetic? It's like, they're not, if they...
Yeah. It might just be another circular conversation where just...
But how do you start? Like, yeah. What you just talked about sounded interesting to me. Like, I could pick a popular song or whatever. Like, I don't care what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
It
reminds me of the That's an Enthymeme game.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like that. Like, it sort of just creates... It forces you to keep making connections and linkages in your own mind and then maybe, like, in the broader cultural space. So, I mean, like, I'd maybe start with a personal example of, like, why I might... And, you know, it can be a little bit awkward, but, like, when you try to deconstruct your own taste in a musician, for instance, like, I love hip-hop and Future and, like, sort of basically, like, the new-ish gangster rap stuff. And so when I interrogate my own taste in that, you can come up with all sorts of weird, interesting connections between yourself and your relation to the larger cultural sphere. So it's not just about, like, well, first of all, you can get into the actual dynamics of the song. So I like these kinds of beats. I like the way they're structured. They're super catchy. So you can get at it from that angle, sort of an aesthetic angle. But then you also look at, like, in terms of, like, who you see yourself as. Who
I'm more interested in the sort of social belonging question of why do you like this music?
Why do you attach yourself to these kinds of figures? And why do you, like, do you see yourself as, or do you wish to be someone like Future or a rapper like that? And how do you see yourself in relation to a figure like that? Like,
or exoticize or whatever. Right, but exactly, you need to give them a machinery. I think you're right that, like, we're used to making those habitual meta moves, and you need to give them a machinery that helps them run and that line. So it has to be like, all right, why do you like it? What, you know, what about, like, isolate the things about it that you like, then ask why do you like those things, and then isolate what about.
What I could do is say, without talking about the song, without talking about the song itself,
right?
So you can talk about the performer, the social persona, the other kinds of, like, but without talking about the song itself, why do you like the song?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. Like, or those who don't like it. I mean, it doesn't matter.
I don't think you would have to make that kind of siloed approach, because I think talking about, I don't know, like, the heavy, you know, beats can get you into the sort of, like, social belonging. Right,
because it is all connected to some extent. Yeah. But you could.
It certainly is. Right. I just want to discourage. It's so cool when he does.
X. Right. Just it's cool. Yeah. Like, you want to get away from that flat.
But that would be a totally fine response to say it's cool when, you know, he, like, there's, like, a build up to the drop of a beat.
Right.
Because you can't stop with it's cool. Then you have to take a step back and say what's cool about him. Like, oh, well, there's a certain kind of tension there that I like when that tension is broken. Okay, well, why do you like that there's a tension broken? I'm like, all right, well, you know, now we're into some Freudian sex shit. I don't know. Like...
Right.
Like, whatever it is, again, I just think you have to give them... This is what I've discovered in any kind of exploratory writing that I give my students, that if I just give them the initial question, they'll write it out in crazy-ass tangents, and it's like... You know, they can't stay close to the thing, right? It's like they give an answer for it, and then they can't write anymore, or they veer off into la-la land. And if you give them a machinery that allows them to stay close to the thing but constantly look at it from a different perspective, then I've discovered that at least when they start doing it, not the first time, but the second or the third or the fourth time, they start to get the hang of it. And this one just seems to me to be like a kind of, you know, pulsating, you know, one question to another question. What do you like about this? What about what you like about this? Or, you know, like, isolate the thing that you like and then figure out why you like the thing that you like. Then isolate the thing that you like about that and then figure out, you know, why you like the part about that. And so it's this analytic movement where it's always figuring, all right, what are the parts? What about the parts? What are the parts of that? What about those parts? And then that will, you know, you might think that's just going to only drill down. My guess is that's going to create some horizontal movement where it's like I'm following the beat, and then the beat is going to lead me to a sense of sort of like exoticism of Black culture or... Right. You know, a desire or a sort of like a malaise with sort of like the blandness of white culture or what, you know, whatever it might be, right?
Yeah. Getting these folks to say exoticism would be extraordinary.
Well, they wouldn't have to say exotic. It's like, you know, or I mean, like, I'm saying something is cool. Yeah, saying something is cool can be like an identification move, or it can be an exoticism move, right? And so like they can say like it's so different from what I am used to and what I grew up with that I'm drawn to it. And then like in your responses, like, you know, one word we have for that is you've exoticized it,
right? And, you know, exoticizing in and through identification, like those two could be cooperative, you know.
Sure.
But obviously, like John was saying, getting students to make that kind of relatively nuanced argument might be difficult. But again, just pressing on those questions, just the how and the why of like, how does he make a cool song? Why is it cool to you? You can at least like, because a lot of students are not familiar with the dynamics of rhetorical analysis, even on a basic level, and theory. So getting it in on a personal angle, I find is sometimes helpful, not always, but like getting them just to interrogate their own taste a little bit, like, because people are not used to that. You just embody your tastes and inclinations every day without questioning why you like this thing or how it affects you, you know, and how it might affect other people differently.
Well, the other thing that I've realized with this is that you have to get away from seeing this as them making an argument about something. So if they fail to or succeed in making an argument about their exoticism, you know, how they've exoticized sort of like a, you know, some marginalized group, like you can't see that as something that they fail to do or succeed in doing. And, you know, I'm really upfront about that with my exploratory arguments is I don't want an argument. And in fact, I want you to presume, you know, making an argument about something presumes a certain kind of mastery, a certain kind of understanding, and I want you to go into this project presuming that you don't have a mastery. That's why you are writing. Right. You are using the writing to figure something out, which means, well, I want you, like, my first year writing classes, what they spend most of their time, most of their writing doing is they read a text that's above their head, and then they begin with an intuition. So, like, you know, like, which could be like, I like it, I don't like it, this was confusing, that was frustrating. And then they turn to passages, they turn to elements of the song, they try to open them up in certain kinds of ways. And then their goal is to create a question that will guide another reading of that text, that will guide another listening of that song or whatever else. So their goal is, like, they write, you know, 2-3 pages just to come up with a question to return to whatever the artifact is. And I don't, and you know, I tell them to treat it, you know, kind of the machinery that I give them is treat it as a kind of thinking out loud where, you know, the writing is you slowing, we always compress our thoughts when we're in our head, the writing slows that process down, it elongates it, it forces you to try to account for connections that you've made and allows you to stall at those connections. Like, well, maybe I think it like this, but I could also see myself going in this direction, or I'm really confused by this thing and I think it's because, and then you start following that train of thought out, then, you know, they just keep on moving that, you know, that thought machine.
Because it's interesting, because we were talking about Coates last week, and this is a separate question that that I'm kind of curious about, that there is within what we would call like AFAM critical discourse, there seems to be a real, in ways that's not true, for instance, with feminism or queer studies, right? Like that there seems to be a real antagonism towards the intellectual, and the person who is like Coates in the position of the intellectual has to always negotiate. Right, like this is the like James Baldwin kind of problem, right? Like, you know, are you being assimilationist if you do theory?
Yeah,
right. Like, is the very act of doing it, and it's troubling to me because I'm clearly on one side in this team. Like, I didn't really know that, but I'm clearly on the side of intellectual life is historically problematic, but ideologically neutral, right? Like, one can mobilize it to do other kinds of things. So I'm clearly on that side, and yet I reckon, it seems to me, and this is a question that I have, is like, is it the case, because I don't spend a lot of time with AFAM theory discourse, but is it the case that one of the reasons that I don't is because it's not very good theory, because of, again, a justifiable, understandable aversion to kind of academic intellectual culture, right? Like, I get why, and I think the reasons make sense, but I am so completely on the other team of that, of like, yes, I get the history of this thing, but that doesn't mean you can't use Foucault or whoever else to problematize questions of race, right? Like, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the first question would be like, does my reaction to that, because I don't have enough experience to really say that's my perspective on this. So, like, does that perspective resonate for you guys? Because I find myself, I'm like, fuck, I wish that I was teaching more AFAM theory. And then every once in a while, like, I will send emails to people and, like, give me stuff to read. And they'll give me stuff to read. And I'm like, eh, it's not that interesting.
Yeah. I think,
like,
there's a reason why, you know, Du Bois still traffics quite a bit and Baldwin still traffics. I mean,
that's what I mean. Because, like, honestly, like, think in terms of feminism. Like, to me, you read the sort of contemporary feminist, whether it's Barad or, you know, whatever versions of the Judith Butler, that's smart. That's really interesting, smart stuff that, like, I need to work through and figure out. And I get excited to do that. Yeah. And then when it turns to AFAM, it's like, I'm just not interested.
I just don't even have any names besides Coates, who's like a peripheral academic.
And he's also more of a public intellectual,
or, you know, who's the one that's always on CNN?
Cornel West.
Obviously Cornel West and
same kind of thing. But, like, I think from my generation, like Henry Louis Gates, right? Like, that's back in the 80s, right? 80s and 90s. And I liked Gates' Signifying Monkey was awesome. I thought that was really interesting. He's trying to do something with Derrida, you know. But Gates is also firmly on my team in that, right? Or I'm on his team, which is inhabit the institution and the intellectual institutions and make them. That's what Signifying is for him, right? So, so I'm like, yeah, I get that, but I feel like someone, and he doesn't do that kind of work anymore, right? Like, Gates, for instance, went, like, sort of full-throated into the recovery of African history in a very traditional sense. Yeah. So it's like there aren't people out there doing the, I would say it this way, who's the Judith Butler of AFAM studies saying questions of authenticity to blackness are a problem for African
I think
studies.
Coates is that figure. I think, and I think that there's a reason why this kind of speaks to a certain antagonism between Coates and Cornel West in that, you know, Cornel West often critiques Coates of being a kind of apologist or assimilationist, where, you know, like, Cornel West has very delicately, I think, configured his position as an academic and, you know, who's both an academic and a public intellectual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, you know, Coates makes it pretty clear that like, the problem is whiteness and blackness, and that, you know, for, like, that problem to transform, like, white people and black people have to become something else, that there is a kind of orientation to a futurism there that is, you know, not simply caught up in, like, authenticity is a problem, I think, for Coates.
Byron would have a lot of figures here too. The whole, you said Afrofuturist. And I haven't really read a ton of that, but he's super tuned into that discourse. And I feel like there's plenty of interesting stuff going on there that does specifically deal with the question of authenticity, like, almost as a central theme. So that, maybe it's just that I'm not attuned to certain discourses, because I'm obviously, surely there are great African-American theorists, black theorists writing right now. It's just that none of them are, like, famous. None of them are Judith Butler famous at that level of theory. Because you wouldn't be able to say that Coates writes in the same register as Butler.
No, right.
It's just not, you know, they have different styles.
So in my first year class, we do Discipline and Punish first, and then Between the World and Me. And part of that movement is always, like, the students, like, holy shit, I can understand Coates. And in a way that I couldn't understand Foucault. And, you know, that sort of questioning exercise that I was telling you about, invariably, when they write the one on Coates, it is significantly worse than the one on Foucault. Because with Foucault, they know they don't get it. They know it's too sophisticated for them. They have to slow it down. They have to work through the connections and build something out of it. And when they read Coates, they think they understand him, and they get angry about what he's saying and sort of, like, self-righteously, like, isn't this terrible? And then they indulge in that. And every time I'm like, do not, you know, do not assume that you understand this, that this is every bit as sophisticated as Foucault, but it is like, it'll lull you to sleep because the writing is so beautiful and the writing is so powerful, and that you will think that you understand it. You do not. Pause. You'll skim over the things like, you know, race is the child of racism, not its mother, and you won't, like, you will not grapple with that. And
this is a very interesting argument, and I have not heard it made, and I'm now going to have to put it in the book. What you just said is a very interesting argument in favor of difficult writing that I haven't heard before, which is one of the things that difficult writing does, and Heidegger actually said, you know, he says almost exactly this in one of the lectures that we read for today, is like, difficult writing disallows you from the ease with which you think what you know what the person is saying, and so you're forced into kind of like a searching or curious or following mode, as opposed to an opinion setting, like responsive answering the question.
Yeah. Right. Defamiliarizes you a little bit.
Right. Like, well, just with the whole, like, you just don't think that you know what's being said, and so therefore, as a result, you're not inclined to say, I agree or disagree intuitively. Like, you don't have that instant reaction. So that's a great argument in favor of challenging, like, why challenging writing is useful is because it slows down the opinion.
And it's in some ways non-representational. Explicitly, right? It's challenging you to, right? It's forcing you to make interpretations rather than facilitating the ease of communication, right? It's not about communicating ideas necessarily you read Foucault. It's about laying out a series of interpretations, the connections that can, you know, that you can follow in a number of ways. Like, it's that's precisely Heidegger's point here.
And Coates gives you that if you don't let the outrage and the desire answer, like, it's there. Like, you know, one of my favorite lines is, you know, he has turned his life into the project of responding to the question of how to live free in his black body, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, because he refuses to make the authenticity move on the one hand, and he deals with the constructedness of, you know, marking bodies as black and aspiring to be white. But on the other hand, he's incredibly committed to the notion that, you know, that this isn't simply an arbitrary mechanism, that it doesn't matter sort of like, you know, how well one body might be constructed within white culture. You know, there are, like, it can always be made reducible to, you know, the color of one's skin. And this is, like, you know, his concern with his son, who, you know, grows up educated and privileged in so many sort of conventional senses. And he's like, and yet you could always be marked and reduced, you know, at any given moment, you know, in any given circumstance. And I was going to say something else there.
No, but that's good. So you've got the sort of dual, like, on the one hand, one's fighting against an identity category. At the same time, you recognize that you can be subjected to that identity category, no matter how much you fight against
interpolation
it.
Interpolation is always possible, even if there's not an authentic call. Even if the call is not authentic,
But that's precisely the reason why it's so important not to offer that call from within the community, right? Like, and that's, to me, like the Dave Chappelle, when keeping it real goes wrong. In fact, I'm going to use that, the Dave Chappelle, that's just straight up about authenticity.
I was going to say, I mean, from at least an outside perspective in black theory discourse, some of the, like, Chappelle, Chris Rock are some of the best theorists in the game. I would say, I mean, bracket Chappelle's recent controversy in his last special. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
We can delete this, but I liked it.
No, I liked it too. But I mean, Jesus, I don't even want to get into that conversation about his relationship with trans culture and all that. But it's a mess, and he created that mess, so whatever. But his specials before that, I mean, you don't have to be trained in theory to be a theorist, and Chappelle is a prime example of that because he has that. Sure. Now, again, you could say it's sort of more of the meta version of theory, where you're always kind of the master commentator on things rather than the, you know, it's the difference between, what was it, like, irony and humor and delusion.
Humor,
right, but I do think, like, if you wanted to teach something to really interrogate race relations in class, like, and a lot of people didn't see this special, but the one that he released right after George Floyd was killed, it was it was a 25-minute, basically.
The one we were outside?
Right. And it's not funny, There's maybe like two jokes. It's just seething and full of rage and pain, but it's super interesting. And so it's like
really good.
Right. Yeah. And I'm going to teach that once I teach again, if I ever teach again, which it feels like I haven't taught in fucking 2 or 3 years. I'm going with that special because it's short, but it's really punchy. It's powerful. And it's a weird artifact because it's a comedy. It's dubbed a comedy special, but it clearly has different aims and effects, you know, in mind.
I was going to say too, that, you know, there is a similarity. You mentioned, you know, you were kind of pitting feminist theory sort of like in relationship to FAM theory. But there is a commonality there. I mean, think about Judith Butler. Judith Butler is not simply owned as a feminist.
Oh,
right?
No, I agree. Yeah. There's, yes.
Precisely
yes.
Because of the authenticity feminist question. Yeah, and right. So, like, you know, the problem of theorizing women has, like, you know, runs into the exact same authenticity question.
Absolutely. I totally get that.
You know, yeah.
But there is at least a kind of institutional intellectual space for problematizing and challenging and engaging. Like,
yeah, and there's a, you know, you could say, I think it kind of runs from, you know, you could say like Simone de Beauvoir is sort of like, you know, a pioneer in that, in a way that, I mean, I don't know. I think Du Bois and, you know, and James Baldwin are, you know, provide that same kind of.
But who are the ones today is the question. That to me, I totally agree with you. And I would map the sort of analogies there and obviously attending to the differences. But like, who are the ones today who are, because there's a level at which I totally agree with you on Chappelle. Like, I really do. I just find Chappelle really, really smart. Like, what Chappelle does is he puts a number of variables in play in any one of his sketches that are a kind of thinking through, like, race, class, gender, you know, a bunch of different elements. But it's still something different than theorizing, right? To me, it is. And so, like, I get it. It's problematic. It's interesting and it's compelling. But it's not all that complex.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the ways that, you know, like Butler, Kirby, Barad are, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I don't know exactly what I mean by that, but I love Chappelle. I mean, I'm very interested in the stuff that he does. I still feel like there's a difference between that and like who's the person who's writing the philosophy/theory version of that. There's a lot here. At least in terms of what I would call like Heidegger's method, right? Like how he is engaging in the thinking that was, it's really great. For me, it was really great where it like, and there are still those sort of, like, as I was reading, I kept writing in the margins. It just feels to me like he's got a commitment to a kind of mysticism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is, there's always like, oh, there's a secret behind the thing and the unspoken that hides within the thing. Yeah. And I mean, there's always that kind of, and I don't know, it just always reminded me of Spinal Tap, like the, you know, where they, the Stonehenge and the, I mean, even though it ended up being a joke, but like, we're trying to create this mystical, quasi-ancient, like where things were sort of, I don't know what the terminology for that is, but I just read that in Heidegger so much that he has that, he's creating that heavy metal sense of like a connection to the ancient roots that is
like
more
the Jack
authentic
Black,
and true,
like,
right?
Yeah, like Jack Black and what's their band?
Yeah, the Tenacious D.
Tenacious D, yeah, like that.
Right,
yeah,
like yeah, that whole like.
Yeah, hyperbolize even further. You know, it's funny that you say that though, John, because you know I've always ever since I took Jerry Wall Lewis's class, you know, on Being in Time, which was a fantastic class, and you know he's sort of like often sort of spoke to the later Heidegger and the sort of like almost mystic. You know, mystical language speaks you, language is the house of being kind of movement. And, you know, like, I hear that over and over and over again. And I see it whenever, like, I often run across and it's like, oh, yeah, I get that. Thomas Rickert gives me some of it as well, too, here and there.
Yeah.
And this particular lecture, the lecture 3, allowed me to dislodge a lot of what I had before sort of articulated as the sort of mysticism in a way that like it demysticized it for me. In I can come up with an account to it. And especially like I have to relax his emphasis or even just completely move away from his emphasis on the originary, the proper, the, you know, I mean, he doesn't use the language of correct often though. But, you know, he has this like I think it's much more of a his problem is the techno usages of words that hide a kind of fertility behind them. And so just imagine, like, what if you just presumed that this sort of techno way of speaking was every bit as possible, okay, maybe not every bit as possible, but, 100 years, 500 years, 2,000 years ago, and that this move of recovering some kind of more ambiguous space of the word has pretty well always been possible, that the sort of a bit of a nostalgic moving back sort of relaxes the grip of a utility-based mobilization of a word, and that allow, like, because to use language, you know, technically it means you generally have to cut off what it's connected to and amplify one connection that it has so that you can be as specific as possible with it, right? Because I want, you know, when I want to exchange something, I want to make sure I get this rather than that. But, you know, that kind of relaxation move would just be to reactivate, you know, those other kinds of connections that have always been there, that have always been sort of established, you know, performatively, you know, sort of right. Over history. And just be like, all right, you know, it would be hard to say that move was actually a move toward authenticity in the way that we would generally think about it contemporarily. We're I would say, like, you know, we tend to think of authenticity as something where we find the right connections. We pinpoint the right techno, you know, assignation of something, and we've now fixed, you know, authenticity in something. And for him, authenticity is far more ambiguous. It actually is this more sort of volatile space where, you know, the word is capable of moving a bit more, of connecting to other usages, other sets of relationships that, you know, like, and it's not shocking to me that, you know, every time he does one of his fun with etymology sections, that it's like, you know, think to thank, to thank you, or thanks, and, you know, this, like, they're always like this network of things. It's like, why he has to use fucking hyphens all over the place, because he has to create these little networks.
Right.
And that's authenticity. That's a weird authenticity.
Right. It's an authenticity that it's a process that has to be facilitated in a difficult and kind of, you know, tortuous way. Like, Heidegger is invested in making authenticity, which is like the opposite of what authenticity is typically defined as, right? Right. It's either found or discovered. It's just what things are. Like, authentic being would just be out there in the world. But for Heidegger, what we are day to day is inauthentic, right? So you have to challenge yourself. You have to break into authenticity somehow through this kind of whatever, like, poetic investigation or poetic mode, you know?
You guys are being very generous, because to me, I mean, and there are moments here that problematize it, and I think that they're important, but I still think, like, if that were the case, then why do we have to constantly go to antiquity? Like, why couldn't we take something from 1935? Right? Like, in other words, the fact that we're always, it's the ancient, you know, it's always the way of the ancients, and we are following the directive of the ancient world, but by no means in sense of a written history, right? Not simply that, like, it's not simply linear history. Now, I will say,
I mean, that moment, I think that phrase is important, you know, but not in the, you couldn't return to the ancients and find, you know, like, the technical legal definition in, like, ancient Rome or something like that, right?
Right, he's not saying that we couldn't find that, right? Yeah, I agree. And in fact, there's a space on 167, he says exactly that. Like, this is the last full paragraph. What is that calling which commends our Western thinking to its own proper beginnings and from there still directs even today's thinking on its way? The thinkers of the fateful beginnings of Western thought did not, of course, raise the question of the calling as we are trying to do now, right? Like, I mean, he says, they didn't raise this question. This was not their question explicitly, right? But he then, what distinguishes the beginning is rather that those thinkers experienced the claim of the calling by responding to it in thought. So there is still, again, like, the first move there is to say, it's not that the ancients got it more authentically. because they didn't. They didn't talk about a calling the way I'm talking about a calling. Mm-hmm. But then the next move is to say, but they felt it and they experienced it. And again, that's to me that sense of the primordial ancient yeah. as being the sort of and everything subsequent to this is the devolution and the technologization of thinking. And I mean, that's to me. So, for instance, like, I just think that Deleuze's conception of sense is way, way, way more interesting, which is simply to say there are multiple senses available.
Yeah,
that's it. Right. Like in any and for me, for instance, there's one. There was one moment that ended up sparking a shit ton of writing for me. So, and this is on 152, and it's kind of, it's not even an incredibly important moment in the developing. So, like, as I'm reading, I'm like, mystical, mystical, mystical. So, like, earlier on the page, the beginning is, rather, this is where he distinguishes between the beginning and the origin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the beginning is, rather, the veil that conceals the origin. An unavoidable veil, like, and again, that thinking of the veil as conceals, mm-hmm. and even of its inevitability, just still has that, like, to me, what I'm calling mystical. Mm-hmm. I wish there was a better word. There's got to be a better word that I've got to figure out of, like, the mystical belief that the ancient ways are better, right? Like that right. the ancient ways saw into a truth of some kind.
Yeah.
But then, so further down the page. But in the paragraph that begins, but now we need take only a few more steps along our way to become aware that situations are expressed in what was said, which we find difficult to access for no other reason than their simplicity. At bottom, a specific access is not even needed here because what must be thought about is somehow close to us in spite of everything. And this was the sentence that really got me going. It is just that it is still hidden from our sight by those old accustomed preconceptions, which are so stubborn because they have their own truth.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why that spawned a bunch of writing for me, because there are two totally different ways of taking that sentence. So that the conventional way, or the way that I tend to read Heidegger, right, in terms of that authenticity thing, is like those old accustomed, those preconceptions, the simplicity with which we form opinions, what we were talking about in terms of difficult writing earlier. They are stubborn, but why are they stubborn? Well, because they have a truth. But their truth is not the sort of interesting aletheia version of truth. It is the technocratic correspondence version of truth. So they have their truth, which is their conception of truth, mm-hmm. which is the technologized conception, and that's what makes them hard to bust. The more interesting version, available in the very same words, right? I mean, you have to look at the German, but is they're stubborn because they have their own truth in the disclosive sense of truth, the aletheia yeah. sense of truth, which is to say they're not any less, that sort of technocratic yeah, yeah, yeah. conceptions with which we form are not any less, you know, pure, genuine, and authentic than the other ones.
Yeah.
And to me, like, there's nothing about the writing of that sentence that tells you one or the other.
Yeah.
Right, like you could, and so to me, I go, well, in that sentence, there are at least two different senses mm-hmm. of the sentence that are available. So,
but they're not even mutually exclusive because, I mean, in that aletheia sense, you know, I mean, think about the question concerning technology, that this techno-capitalistic language discloses the world as standing reserve, right? So it is a disclosure. Right, and I think it would be hard pressed to say that it's any more or less authentic. But Heidegger just really, really doesn't like it. And there's definitely a way in which, you know, Heidegger just sees, you know, techno-capitalism as
yeah,
a
virus.
Yeah,
but for Heidegger, I think, yeah, that's right. But I think for Heidegger, it's exactly the inauthentic, right? Like, that's yeah. exactly what is the sort of, and that's the covering over and the forming of preconceptions. Yeah. But here you have the possibility of those preconceptions yeah. being formed as their own kind of disclosiveness, yeah. not simply of a disclosiveness of a technocratic failure to,
but that,
you know,
is a
things.
Disclosiveness. Like, it is a configuration, right? I thought when
of
you were saying earlier.
Inferior relation to being, though.
About what if we ran with Deleuze's and Spinoza's notion of joy and sadness here? And I think that language, you know, joy as the increasing of a body's capacity to affect and be affected by others, and sadness as the decreasing of a body's capacity to affect and be affected by others. And, you know, like, I think for Heidegger, what techno-capitalistic language does, what techno-capitalistic aletheia does as a disclosure of the world in a particular kind of way, reduces the number of ways in which bodies can affect and be affected. They overdetermine the way that bodies can affect and be affected for each other, and that is sad. And, you know, and then that this recovery project, it's not that you're getting to the right set of relationships, it's that you are literally increasing the capacity for a word to affect and be affected by others.
Right. But it's a difficult process to sort of shake that infrastructure, right? I mean, part of Heidegger's argument is that human being is defined by its withdrawal from human being. So it's not just that we get an open access to being or becoming, it's that human nature, at least, I mean, he doesn't make this sort of historical argument, but at least, after industrialization, is defined constitutively by withdrawal. So it's like what you were saying about like the kind of dual nature of that sentence, or necessarily conflicting interpretations. I mean, I think you can see Heidegger here is arguing for that sort of, well, I don't know what you would call it, like not a relativism, but like
no, but see, well, even in that story, like I'm totally buying your guys' more complex version of the story, and it's still a story of loss, right? Like. It's still a story of lost possibilities, lost options, as opposed to telling the exact same fucking story and thinking of the potential and availability of possibilities.
Right.
Same fucking story. But what one loses is the kind of romantic ethos of the ancient.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you could talk about this in the context of Walmart as much as you don't need to go to Plato, right? Like I mean, I'm just saying, like, it's... the idea that one can simply say, that's what I'm saying, there's a kind of moral judgment implicit in that story of loss, no matter how complex the story gets, that I don't think is necessary to do the kind of, like, all of the sort of possibilities of awakening within thinking, the thanking, the all of these things, the possibility of activating those other kinds of senses do not require a prehistory of loss.
No.
You know?
But
they can simply be multiple. That's why I'm saying the Deleuze version of the multiplicity of senses gives me a much more interesting way of thinking about that.
Yeah. You know? No, you're right. I mean, there's definitely a sentimentality to Heidegger that's just sort of unappealing or not as relevant, not as attuned to the speed of modern culture. Like, that's why Deleuze,
I think...
He
likes walking in the Black Forest more than he does, you know, like, and I get that. I liked walking in the Black Forest. I did that.
Like, your question at the beginning, I think, is pretty relevant and interesting to me. It's like, can you bracket that obsession or at least implicit nostalgia from the more interesting stuff? And ultimately, I don't think you can, but what does that mean when you're diagnosing Heidegger? Is that just an idiosyncrasy of his, or is it a constitutive part of his thinking?
That's the question, because I find the places when he's talking, especially like in chapter 6 where he's, or lecture 5, I guess, I don't remember which ones we read. The last one we read, where he talks about the way and the establishing of the way, and that questioning moves on the way. It doesn't end. And so to answer the question means to continue the way. And the way is a clearing of the path, but there's no path behind you after you've cleared it. In fact, the thing that you've cleared is now what's in front of you. And I'm like, that's fantastic, right? Like, I'm totally with him in terms of the movement of thinking in the direction. And I don't believe, Nate, I mean, this is just my sense, I don't believe that one needs to have a sense of an originary, proper, in order to say those things, to say, like, here's what's possible for thinking. It can go this way instead of that way. And you don't need to say it used to go this way or this was available in the ancient language. Like, I just don't think that one needs any of that.
But there, I think you can extract the ancients had it better. But I don't think you can extract the notion of a kind of more authentic thinking if authenticity is nothing more than the defamiliarizing, the uncoupling of techno language. That, you know, in other words, sort of like the disclosure, you know, like I always imagine it like, you know, you're creating that path in the woods, and sure. then, you know, the aletheia is like, there is this opening, and it shows you a handful of different directions, not an infinite number of directions that you can go, but definitely not right. just one direction that you can go. Right. And one way of reading that is that that is the correct, you know, intersection of thoughts, and it needs to be maintained. But what you just said, I think, you know, is what I would buy, is like, no, you just have to be able to access a handful of paths. And as soon as you choose one, that clearing that you just gave
right.
gets reconfigured. It would have to be right. reactivated. You couldn't go back there in the sense of like that technocratic sense of memory. And, you know,
right.
Nate, you're totally right, especially like in Being in Time, that, you know, Dasein is sort of informed by a kind of... you know, kind of self-alienation or, you know, something to that effect. But here he over and over says that the essential nature of Dasein, the essential nature of the human, is thinking, is
yeah.
which is fundamentally a self-transformative process. That and I love, and this to me, I really want to talk about
but
this.
But that's the question. Why does he have to claim that it's the essential nature? Why can't it simply be like one possible essential nature?
This is what really, really interests me about this entire series of lectures, is I think there's an embedded kind of, whether implicit or sort of hidden or whatever else, a response to Levinas in the way that he configures the relationship between thinking to thinking, and that there is a, like, for him, contending or responding to food for thought is simultaneously the essential nature of the human and the capacity of it self-overcoming, and that is also a thanking for its own being, that the capacity mm-hmm. to think is a, I mean, let's call it the other, let's call it difference, is like the capacity to treat difference or the other as food for thought, which, you know, in that Levinasian terminology is like, you know, the eternal debt. I am eternally indebted to the other for the possibility of my own emergence. Except for here, Heidegger is configuring that being as essentially a thinking and essentially a responding to the other. So how does one thank the other? Not by offering up an exchange, which would make the notion of infinite debt impossible to imagine, or at least would force it, like, it wouldn't even make sense to ever pay or fail to repay that debt to the other, because the only way, you don't pay the debt, you give thanks to the debt, or you don't even a debt, you give thanks to, you know, the conditions of my, you know, human nature of right. being able to think by responding to the thing. And right. that would give a different sense of the infinite, which would be, now I'm eternally responding to the thing, which would involve my self-transformation, its self-transformation, yeah. the blurring of the boundaries between me and it and the first one. Like, what happens when just responding,
like that,
to the other
the
is...
I like that, with it, that it reconfigures the notion of debt.
Yeah.
And he's really explicit. He's like, it's not a debt that
yeah.
is to be repaid, right? Like, he says right. that really explicitly.
And how so. Technocratic is the very notion of debt to begin with?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, and just to mark out the path. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Nate. If you had
no, I was just gonna say just briefly. Like, I think one of the issues or one of the problems or dangers here is that endowment or that the gift, that the constitutive gift of otherness that we receive as humans is often received as a threat. You know, and mm-hmm. so the challenge is to open yourself up to that gift. But the tendency of human being is to reify or reduce otherness mm-hmm. in the pursuit of whatever, representations of the world. Something, you know, right. the safety of a life world where you can mark borders and et cetera. So,
yeah, no, I think that's yeah. right. Like, so for me, the sort of encapsulation of this is the very
but that would be technocratic capitalistic. Sorry, I mean, just to say that very impulse is the impulse of, you know, the making exchangeable of beings, right? The creation of yeah. the ontic, so it can be stabilized and exchanged. That is the impulse of the technocratic, which, you know, again yeah. for him would be less authentic because it is a shutting down of it is the shutting down of otherness.
Right. Yeah, but in that sense, okay, but in that sense, isn't he basically saying the problem is ever making a decision, right? Like, ever making a determination, right? Like, yeah. that what you do when you make a decision or a determination is you're reducing big B being to little B beings, right? Yeah. Like, the ontic. And so that there is a sense of, in that way, it's like, well, the only solution, which is a non-solution, is death, which is absolute transcendence, right? Mm. Like, because any decision you make is getting you involved with a particular other, not, you know, big B being. And, I mean, so to me, the encapsulation of these kinds of questions is the very end of what we just read, 160, the very bottom of 168 onto 169 and then 170. But, like, I'll just read the chunk that I really like. Thinking itself is a way. We respond to the way only by remaining underway. And bracket the next part for a second and flip over to 170. So, you know, we respond to the way only by remaining underway. So that's what response is by remaining underway. And then on top of 170, if we are to remain underway, we must first of all and constantly give attention to the way. The movement step by step is what is essential here. Thinking clears its way only by its own questioning advance, but this clearing of the way is curious. The way that is cleared does not remain behind, but is built into the next step and is projected forward from it. That's what we were just talking about a few minutes ago. So that's what it means to remain underway. But then flip back to on top of 169, where we just left off, remaining underway. To be underway on the way in order to clear the way, that is one thing. The other thing, and this is where, you know, you can imagine. The other thing is to take a position somewhere along the road and there make conversation about whether and how earlier and later stretches of the way may be different. And in their difference might even be incompatible. Incompatible, that is, for those who never walk the way, never set out to it, but merely take up a position outside of it. They're ever there forever to formulate ideas and make talk about the way. So that's the technocratic one.
Yeah.
Right, the sort of step along the side of the sit along the side of the path and don't make a way. And again, that's where I'm like, why is that not just a different making of the way?
Yeah,
you know, why is that not just a slower or different rhythm,
an intensity, you know, a certain kind of intensive shift,
right? Where that's where to me my terminology of style is super helpful, because you can just be like, these are different styles of becoming.
They
don't like each other, right? They don't resonate, they don't, you know, hook well together, but it's not because one is taking a path outside of the way and the other is moving along. It's because they're just two different styles of moving along or taking a position.
I think he does waver on this question, though. I mean, you're right. In this instance, it does feel like he's making a pretty strict opposition between styles of being or dispositions. But that other sentence you brought up, where the slightly different inflection would be that the technocratic version
has its own truth.
Has its own truth, not in the sense that it owns the kind of knowledge-based, content-based version of truth, but that it articulates a truth.
That's great. Like, that's
right in its version.
But it's that question of, is that me doing that to Heidegger via Deleuze, or is that Heidegger? But the interesting question is, they're both available in the sentence.
Yeah.
Like, that to me is the thing that I think I can say. Now, again, I got to go to the German, but I know, I mean, it's not like it's complex terminology, right?
I think,
like,
it's Heidegger. Cool. I mean, I think both the kind of reduction of that and the demarcation between the styles, that's Heidegger, and the
collapse. That sure is Heidegger.
The collapsing of them is also, I mean, to me, that's how I always read what the treasure of metaphysics was, where it's like the withdrawal from being as a fundamental tendency of human being. That's why metaphysics is not simply a flaw in thinking. To position yourself above the physical or natural world, because it's a tendency, that's what makes it valuable, and you can diagnose it in certain ways, right? And so it's not that they're simply wrong. In fact, they're not wrong.
Oh, for sure.
Metaphysicians are not wrong. They just are exercising a particular way of relating.
I can't believe I'm going to be the first one to bring up Hegel, but this just sort of reminds me. I blame you, Nate.
Well, this is like Nate's. I mean, it's very much like Nate's Zizekian version of Hegel, right? Like, I see that connection.
Well, but in that, you know, that sort of like stepping off of the way to, you know, think about, demarcate, map the way, and sort of try to, like, configure, you know, this entire terrain, say, like, according to a set of principles, right? That sort of representational movement is not instantaneous. right? Yeah. Like the introduction of the logic might be seem like it's instantaneous, but the labor of actually mobilizing it will produce a whole bunch of internal contradictions that then will force the logic to change. And it makes me think very much of the operation, so like, you know, those kind of paradigm shifts that, that Hegel talks about, where, you know, like the nascent idea, like gains a footing because it can do something that the previous sort of like paradigm wasn't able to do, but it takes a while to sort of reconfigure the everyday sort of operation of things. And that labor itself is a style of movement. And mm-hmm. what Heider doesn't like about it is that there's like a fascistic nature to it. That, you know, what I think what he would like to see is that at every step it undoes itself and remakes itself. But that would, to me, just be about a matter of speed, right? That, you know, because it, I think Hegel is the one that shows that it doesn't matter how deep down you drill, it is never a homogeneous operation where whatever that sort of guiding principle is simply stamps itself everywhere. That the very running out of itself is its own self undoing. Now it operates through a kind of self negation and whatever. But the fact is that it cannot be a stagnation.
No.
Right. I agree. Good, And that and I think the thing for me, and this is maybe just my style, right, in a sense, is like I'm always sort of hunting out, and certainly when it comes to Heidegger, for obvious historical reasons, like the ways in which a kind of moralism and the establishing of a certain way of establishing distinctions, because it's not like I'm against distinctions, but a certain way of establishing distinctions becomes moralism, you know, in subtle ways. I mean, I return to, you know, Brooke is the one who pointed this out to me, but in Difference, when I taught Difference back in September or whatever, and Derrida describes the thinking of Difference as going after everything in us that wants a kingdom. And I'm like, that just so hooked for me, which is like, that's what I find myself often doing is, what is there in Heidegger that wants a kingdom? And here it's the kingdom of being, right? Like in its more authentic, originary, proper sense, as interesting and complex and performatively enacted as that is, giving it its full due, and yet still wants to say there is something that's not that, that's standing on the side of the path and not making a path. And so I'm like, and that's where for me, I say there's a clear connection. His argument or his problem is against a kind of fascistic technologization, but there's a fascism with which he approaches it, right?
Yeah, he's fascistically opposed to fascism.
Right, and that to me, that's exactly what I learned from Derrida, is that the target is always that within it which wants a kingdom, which wants to be in the place of the moral high ground. So, and I think that's the reason that I'm constantly zeroing in on those kinds of moments of like, yeah, it can, you know, that sentence, why that sentence is really interesting to me is because it could go, you know, the usual Heideggerian interpretation, and I suspect how everyone reads that sentence would be like, oh yeah, they had their truth, but their truth is the, you know, technologized version of truth. Right. But what if you read it as they have, you know, the more interesting version of truth? Then you're just selecting between two disclosures of being, one not being on the sidelines any more than the other one is on the sidelines. And then you have to talk about, I actually think that's what style has to offer, is because you can talk about these things as conflicting without one being right.